There's so much misinformation out there. You overpronate and you might need a stability shoe. If anyone's ever told you running's bad for your knees, slap them.
No offense to all the runners out there, but you're all pretty challenged.
Physical bent. Post run beer is one of the best beers you'll ever have.
You never feel shit after a run.
You'll get fit, you'll get strong, you'll get healthy.
Running is fucking awesome. Hi Mike, I'm Dutch. I work as a massage therapist.
My name's Pat. I'm a running coach, physio. I'm an avid runner myself. We thought we'd call the podcast That's Running.
Cool. We're back. Well, not we. Me and Sally are here. Mike's not because he's gone home with a migraine.
Poor Mike.
Poor Mike. He gets migraines and, yeah, not great. Migraines that you just cannot function on. But we've got Sally here.
Hello.
Yeah, Sally Coggins, vet, runner. What else do you do?
Coach.
Coach.
And research scientist at the moment doing my PhD.
So. Yeah. So like healthy cross-section between like intellectual nerd and like...
Self-confessed nerd.
And trail freak.
Yep.
So Sal... I could do like five different podcasts with Sally because we could talk about a whole bunch of different things that she does that have to do with running and some that don't have to do with running. But Sal, what we're going to touch on today is something called Red S, right? Which is a bit of an issue in the running community.
Hmm.
Can you tell me in 20 seconds what Red S is?
So Red S is relative energy deficiency in sport, and essentially it's an energy mismatch. So it sort of boils down to what's going in isn't keeping up with what's coming out, and I guess the sort of flow-on effects impact a whole bunch of different body systems, and it can be quite hard to know that you're in that state until something pretty severe happens.
Yeah. Good. That was very succinct. Yeah. So It's something that's not obvious, especially if you're not looking out for it. And if you miss it, you can run into some serious troubles as an athlete, as an endurance athlete, especially.
Definitely.
That's what we're going to touch on. And it's pretty important because I think, and part of the reason why Sally wanted to have this conversation, get this out there, is it's not talked about. And we most people don't know about it. Even me as a health professional who works with endurance athletes, like, there's not enough of a big discussion about it because it's probably more prevalent than we think.
Yeah.
And its effects are, yeah, not fun.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of complexity too, which can make it a hard thing to discuss because there can be sort of a bunch of psychological factors that can be impacting things that can make it a bit of a difficult conversation or this sort of concept of whether it's an intentional or an unintentional energy deficit.
Yeah, so we're going to get into that. But I want to talk about Sal a little bit first. So, Sal, you're a runner?
I am.
For how long?
I've been running seriously, I guess, for a bit over 10 years now.
Okay. 10 years.
Yeah.
So what does serious mean? Does that mean
it's been a focus.
Okay.
A significant focus and something I think about and actively pursue in my spare time for the last 10 years.
Okay. See, I told you she was a bit of an intellectual, very nerdy, considered response. Whereas I'm like, I just fucking love running.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much all of us, I think.
So what are we talking? We're talking 5Ks, we're talking maras, we're talking trails. Are we talking...
I guess my poison
Olympics
choice.
Or beginner? What are we talking?
I would still consider myself sort of in the recreational sphere. I'm very passionate about running and somewhat obsessed with running, but I'm not a naturally gifted runner. It's something I think I have to work pretty hard at, and that's probably what I've really enjoyed about it is that I have to sort of be smart with my training. I've had a lot of injury history, some of which we'll probably touch on. But I love it. I love all aspects of running. I love the community around running. I love the ability to connect with nature. As I said, my poison of choice is generally in the ultramarathon sphere.
Yeah.
It sort of started out as, more road distances and doing a few road maras, and then like many people, I read Born to Run and bought some Vibram five fingers and started running trails.
this is the answer to life. Wow. I've actually got 3 copies of that book at home between myself and my housemate that we just keep getting them.
It's like, have you read this book?
If anyone wants a copy.
Eat some chia seeds and run in the canyons. Yes, we could go wrong.
Eat some chia seeds, eat corn and drink beer and you run all day. Yeah. I always worried about sunburn reading that book. I'm like, they're just running all day in the Mexican canyons.
Yeah, right. It's
like, I couldn't.
No.
I'd get sunburned. That was.
I'm going to be honest, that has never crossed my mind.
It's like they run all day in the desert. It's like,
I was thinking more about the drug lords that would kidnap you and kill you. Yeah, but...
that part of Mexico. Anyway, it's a great book, but it's not what we're talking about. But you're signing up, you've signed up and you're going to do UTA 100.
Yeah, so I've done a bunch of ultras, I guess. So pretty much for the last 5 years, my focus has been ultras. So I've done a bunch of 50s, a few sort of 60 to 70 and an 85 over at Tarawera. And I did Surf Coast Century as my first 100. I think I've paid for UTA 3 times. The first time I had to pull out due to injury, and we'll probably touch on that one later. The second time was 2019, and I was the fittest I've ever been and had the most extreme gut issues I've ever had and DNF'd my first race. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I passed out just before Fairmont, so almost at the 7 kind of K range.
Yeah, and didn't you wake up in a bush or something?
Yeah, I woke up in a front yard and every time I stood up I spewed and passed out again. So that was sort of the end of the day for me, unfortunately. So 2020 was, you know, yeah, let's go back and nail this 100. And I've just had relocated from Melbourne up to Sydney last year. So ideal to be training in the Blue Mountains, except when I arrived, everything was on fire. Then COVID happened and I was locked in my apartment. I got very familiar with the Bay Run, which I'm glad I lived near, but not much in the way of trails, unfortunately. And then obviously the event was delayed. So, yeah, it's a rollover entry.
Okay. So UTA again this year.
I think COVID's really forced one to get in touch with embracing the process and enjoying the day to day. But honestly, I think there's just a general sense of apathy in me at the moment. I just can't commit to getting really excited about an event, I think, until I'm at the start line.
Yes.
Yeah. Everything just keeps falling away at the last minute. But the intention is UTA 100. I love the course. Mm-hmm. I just think it's the perfect mix of, runnable and single track and beautiful views. And I love the Blue Mountains. I always have. My family, we're living up in the Blue Mountains, so it's like Christmas, and that's where we've always kind of hung out. Yeah. So it's a wonderful space.
And so go into the bush for 16 hours and hurt yourself. And
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Hurt yourself in the right ways. That's my...
Yes.
If I can finish and not have vomited, that's going to be an amazing achievement for me.
Okay.
Glamorous sport.
Everyone has their own standards. No vomit.
Yeah, look, this one for me, it's purely I just want to survive it.
Does that mean that you're allowed to cry and shit yourself?
Oh, yeah.
It will still be considered a success as long as you don't vomit.
Even if I vomit once, it's still an improvement on the last time. No, I think in retrospect too, like when I was hitting this in 2019, after I signed up, my beautiful sister also got engaged and set her wedding for the weekend after, and I had like a whole bunch of pressure on me in terms of being able to take leave from work, and there was just all of this stuff that had cropped up. I had to be on a plane by midday the next day. And so it was the sort of thing where if I think there'd just been a constant background pressure of I need to get this done in one go. The cutoffs for UTA are enormous though. So if I had my time again, my gut started to turn after Aquatic Center. And sort of really turned as soon as I hit Giant Staircase and sort of down into the main stair section. And I think reworking that, there's a good chance I probably actually would have just stayed at Aquatic Center for an hour or two and just like made sure. I think if I'd warmed up and just let my gut settle and just been super chill and not put a heap of pressure on myself, it probably would have come good, because after a few hours in the emergency or the hospital sort of tent, you know, by, I think it was about midnight that night, I felt good.
Like, I could keep running.
Yeah, I'm like, well, I mean, my gut settled. I mean, I didn't feel amazing, but, you know, my legs were great the next day. Mm. I just, it was so frustrating. Yeah. The body was ready, but my stomach just wasn't.
Yeah. It's funny, like every ultra I've done, I've learned something.
Oh, yeah.
I've stuffed up that many events, and your learning was like more gut-related stuff.
Mm.
Others, it's more performance or strength or race management.
Yeah, or blisters or like chafe or.
Or chafe, yeah. No, I've learned chafe. That's ticked now. I know that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
And your anti-chafe, I think, is really important too. I think my worst chafe was Tarawera 85, which again was another. It was meant to be 100, but gut issues hit me then, and I ended up missing the turn off. But so it was a different course at that stage, and you had to do like this extra loop, and I just completely went straight through, missed the turn off, and got to the next aid station and realized that I had missed the turn and that I wasn't going to be able to do the 100 course, so you had to finish the 85. But that it was just wet all day. It was just like 12 hours of constant rain, and the product I was using at the time, I couldn't reapply once my skin was wet. So I had it there ready to go and it just did nothing. So
Hurts.
Yeah.
That hurts just thinking about that.
It's terrible.
Let's go to the other UTA that you didn't get to because of injury. Just can you tell us about why we're here?
Yeah. So I guess I stepped up from the sort of road marathon sphere and realized that, oh my God, we had a trail ultra marathon in Victoria, and signed up for Surf Coast Century. So I ticked off that first 100, and in retrospect, like, such a good day.
Yeah.
You don't realize how good you've got it until you have a few really shit days on the trail.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was on a bit of a high. I'd had a few niggles kind of moving into that. I'd been mixing up a few things in terms of getting interested in different ways of fueling. So I'd been sort of a pretty traditional high carb kind of approach in terms of my run fueling at that stage, and then got interested in this like low carb, high fat stuff and keto, and, you know, should I go fat adapted, and can I fuel off nut butter, and started working with a dietitian that sort of had an interest in that sphere. And so I changed up my nutrition strategy going into Tarawera. So I did Surf Coast in the September, Tarawera I was signed up for in the February, and then I'd signed up for UTA 100 in the May. So essentially 300K races in less than 12 months that was my first essential.
And so trying to maintain that fitness and that load for 12 months.
Yeah.
That high 100K load.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I backed up pretty well after Surf Coast Century. I ended up doing Melbourne Marathon a month later just because I wanted to go for the Spartan, like try and get 10 done, and May as well. It's just a marathon. I think that's the risk when you've been sort of ultra training, is like your long runs are long and you sort of don't really appreciate how much recovery is still needed and how much you're still recovering as well. I think there's a lot of sort of CNS and hormonal depletion that happens with big events that you don't even realize how tired you are.
Deplete all of your systems.
Yeah.
That tripped me up last year. I got to the point where my legs were cool with a 70K run, and I did two of them 2 weeks in a row, and then my body was like, fuck you, Pat. And I was like, oh, yeah, fair enough.
Here's a bit and of then stress.
makes you step back and be like, actually, that is a lot. But once you get caught up in that world of doing this long-distance stuff all the time, you just normalize it.
And the people that you're hanging out with, it's, you know, they're...
Encourage it.
Yeah, they're drinking the Kool-Aid.
Thanks, Ollie. So ridiculous kind of training load for too long.
Ridiculous training load. And then I decided, I just got it in my head, I really wanted to get better on downhills. So I started doing a fair bit of training up in the mountains and running with people who were a lot more proficient on downhill. And I think just trying to keep up with them didn't lead to success. I ended up sort of partially chipping some cartilage under my patella, actually, at that stage, which got me in front of a sports doc for the first time who, you know, was, I guess, having some pretty strong opinions on my training load.
As most doctors do.
And essentially sort of said, look, you could do UTA, but you'll definitely need surgery afterwards. And that's going to set you up for a lifetime of arthritis in that joint. Or you could chill the fuck out, not do UTA, come back gradually and, you know, avoid surgery. So although I had a complete nervous breakdown about it and there was many tears, I obviously opted for a bit of self-preservation at that stage. And so I went, okay, look, let's take a bit of a hard reset. I was interested in, you know, maybe improving my running form because I was sort of worried that that was maybe contributing to some knee pathology. So that was actually when I connected with my coach, Nathan Fenton. So he was doing some technique work initially. So I started working with him and I thought, look, this is a great time to tweak form because I'm coming back. It's really low volume. I've got time to sort of adapt to all of this.
Yep.
But I think in the background, there was probably more going on psychologically than I really recognized or was prepared to admit to. I think, you know, I'd certainly gone down this sort of keto rabbit hole. And I think one of the benefits, but also one of the downsides of, you know, social media and the way that we're sort of sourcing information and connecting with people is this, you know, self-perpetuating confirmation bias that happens. Like the more you start searching stuff, the more it's in front of you and, you know,
put yourself in an echo chamber.
Yeah, 100%. And it's so easy to interpret, you know, journals and statistics and all sorts of things in a very biased way and whether you're doing it intentionally or not. And I mean, I'm a trained scientist, like I should be able to read a scientific journal objectively, but I think when there's sort of more going on under the surface, I was just putting myself into more and more of a rigid space in terms of what I saw was the right thing for me and to eat and how much.
If you're looking for something, you'll find it, but if you're not looking for something, you won't find it. And I guess you're looking for things to confirm that keto was a good idea.
And so I'm like,
and
I
you'll find it. And you'll find it. If you're looking for things to say keto's good, you'll find it.
Yeah. So, you know, we tweaked a few things and I was building up some volume and I thought I was doing well. And then, you know, this was over sort of a 6 to 8 month period. I had decided I wanted to sort of go back and have another crack at Tarawera. And so we just started increasing my volume a little bit and it was a very benign Wednesday group session where I rocked up and did a few laps just to sort of warm up and could feel this sort of tightness in my foot, which it just kind of felt like a joint that needed to crack, like that kind of pressure or just something that needed to sort of warm up and release, but just didn't get any better. And then I did the first couple of efforts of the session and it was definitely getting worse. So I went, no, I'm not going to run through pain. I'm in tune with my body. I'm going to stop. And I think that was kind of the first time I felt really blindsided because I hadn't been running with knowing that there was sort of pain, like it wasn't something I'd been sticking my head in the sand about physically in that regard. But, you know, this pain, unfortunately, turned out to be a stress fracture in my cuboid bone of my right foot, which is kind of one of the blockier bones a bit higher up in the foot. And it took 4 weeks to kind of figure that out. We deloaded it. There was sort of thoughts that maybe it was a tendon insertion, like the peroneal tendon or something. So deloaded it for a while and then tested it again. And that's when it really blew apart and I was really sore with it. So I ended up in front of a sports doctor for the second time, was put in a moon boot for a few months, got the moon boot the day before my birthday. That was a hoot. And I think that was where things got really hard because I knew I wasn't going to be able to exercise to the same level that I had been. I was already, you know, running quite a few days a week. I was at the gym pretty much every day a week. I was doing personal training 2 times a week. I was doing spin classes as well. I was working, you know, quite a high pressure. I was running my own small business or, you know, an owner in a small business. We did long hours. There was a lot of stress from, I guess, work and other aspects of my life. Sleep generally was the thing that got canned because I wanted to fit in training. And so there was just this kind of increasing load of stress that I was putting on myself. At the same time, I was getting more and more sort of stuck in, well, I think, you know, really looking back at it, there's been some body image issues from the start. Like I had in my head that surely if you run a couple of marathons, you're not going to have cellulite on your stomach. Like surely that, you know, if you're a marathoner, you will look a certain way. And I think those little background thoughts were probably what were driving an increasingly sort of disordered approach to things.
Yeah.
And I'd become increasingly restrictive in how many calories I was eating, because I just found that if I ate any more than that, it was like my body was just used to this and I'd put on weight really easily. And I wanted to be lighter so I could run faster, and I wanted to look a certain way, and it wasn't happening. And so surely I need to restrict more because I want to be thinner. But I was, keto sort of gave me this out, because if you're, you know, fat adapted, you're just metabolizing fat and your body loves fat and you've got body fat. So by being in a severe calorie deficit, it wasn't really starving myself because I trained my body to know what to do. Like there was all this bullshit that I was feeding myself to essentially disguise the fact that I was really severely limiting my caloric intake and had essentially ended up with a pathologic stress fracture because of it.
Yeah.
And then when you're unable to exercise, that was where things really unraveled, because I didn't, my default at that point was, well, I should eat even less because I can't run.
Yeah, I can't run. I'm going to put on weight. Let's eat less.
Yeah. And that, you know, is pretty sad in retrospect. And it really wasn't until I came out of the moon boot and had started reloading a bit, doing some walk-run kind of progressions, things I thought were going okay. And then I had another setback and ended up back in the moon boot for a couple of weeks. And really it was that second kind of stint where my world kind of came crashing down. And and I think that was where I just, again, I'm still shocked at how far down that rabbit hole I ended up, because you know, I never was diagnosed with a formal eating disorder, and I didn't have any issues through high school or anything. And then all of a sudden I'm like pathologically exercising and, you know, just keep abusing my body with more and more restrictive tendencies to my own detriment. And I knew I was doing it at that point. It was like, I know I need to eat more, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid of eating anything. Food was just numbers to me. It was macros to me. Like I wouldn't eat carbohydrates. I was, you know, 6 black olives was okay, but 10 black olives was too many carbs. Like everything was being tracked on apps. I just, there was no flexibility. I had increasingly severe gut issues. Like I've had some IBS kind of symptoms, and that was getting worse and worse and worse. So I was even more afraid of food, because food made me feel physically sick as well. And so I just ended up in a really, really bad space. And I knew, you know, I guess at that point, I also hadn't had a menstrual cycle for over 6 months. And the 2 years before that, it had been super sporadic. Mm. And I was losing a lot of hair, and my skin was turning to shit, and I was having these random allergic reactions to things. And it was just like my iron was low, my B12 was low, my vitamin D was low. Everything was fucked. And I knew I needed to eat, and I'm sitting there, like, I distinctly remember it was my day off from work, and I knew I needed to eat more, and I'm holding this banana trying to force it into my mouth, and I got halfway through before I just burst into tears and fell on the floor. I'm like, who is this woman that is in this state right now? Like, I just didn't even recognize myself. So it was a really hard time, because I think a lot of what starts you moving down that road is initially still a good intention. Like my main intention was I wanted to improve my running performance. That was kind of where I got interested in running nutrition and you know, how you structure training load and you know, mixing up intensity and adding in strength training, and like all of this stuff has so much merit, and I do all of it now as well, But yeah, it just got a little bit misguided. And I think the more you're in that state, the more reinforced it gets. And I think, you know, some of the more recent literature coming out about REDS, there are definitely links psychologically between like you can't make good decisions for yourself when you're in that sort of energy depletion. So yeah, it was a really rough couple of years.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Sal.
It's all right.
That's yeah.
And I guess I'm quite happy. I'm quite open about it because again, like I wouldn't have picked myself as being someone that was necessarily at risk for this.
You're smart. You understand science and what science is.
I understand physiology. Like I've been trained in all of this shit. Like it's animals, but it's
animals eat food
and similar. They've got the same hormones. Like there's the same feedback mechanisms.
Sally is a vet, by the way. She's a doctor for animals.
A doctor for animals. So it's kind of hard, and I think this is why we need to talk about it more because you can start off very much in this unintentional space and then it can morph into something a lot more. And again, the sort of things you're reading and the things you're exposing yourself to can reinforce that for a lot longer before you really recognize where you're at. And I think, you know, the newer stuff in terms of REDS that's coming out, really the biggest thing is we need to increase awareness of this in general across sport, full stop. And I think the awareness is certainly coming from the top in that, you know, top coaching and professional sort of athlete development programs are certainly recognizing this a lot more. Yeah. I think people in youth development are recognizing this a lot more. I was certainly really encouraged when Athletics Australia revised their training modules for sort of coaches that they've included a REDS module now. So it's slowly filtering down. Yeah. But when you look at our recreational running population, we're a bunch of people that are super passionate. We're setting out with good intentions, but we're also managing full-time jobs and families and everything else that professional athletes don't necessarily have to do. You know, I think it's really easy for us to slip into this energy deficiency.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's like if we think about energy deficiency, we're talking like what you're putting in your body versus what your body's expending. And like inherently, like kind of like the most simplistic view, which is probably too simplistic, but the most simplistic view of losing weight is more out than in. Like there's more to it, but that's kind of like
it is.
If you want to be losing weight, that's what you got to do. But losing weight and stressing your body with exercise, stressing your body with like not sleeping great, stressful work, family life is stressful, whatever, like stressing your body in a caloric deficit with endurance sport is like that's how you run into serious troubles. And unfortunately it manifests as why have you got a stress fracture in your foot? Do you reckon it's your running technique? Mate, it's not your running technique. It's let's take a step back. And
again, I think there's more of an awareness on like, you know, recovery, I think. But I mean, you can spend as much time in Normatec boots as you like. If you're chronically starving yourself, you're not recovering. Like there's a whole different layer of recovery that I just don't think we're recognizing. And again, I think part of it is we just don't realize. Or we do and we're just not fessing up to it yet.
And it's like you think all this like starving yourself for body image is like, oh, are we talking about, you know, a 14-year-old girl who reads too many magazines? Like, no, we're like in the case of Sally, it's like an intellectual person who's studied science and understands science and is a vet and is a pretty smart runner. But you, as we've just said, you've kind of found yourself in that situation. It's males as well. It's probably more prevalent in females, but it's definitely there in males as well.
I think women, are more hormonally susceptible to it. But so essentially in terms of risk factors for this, you know, syndrome, and I guess to backtrack a little bit, where it really evolved from was this concept of the female athlete triad, which I think people are a bit more familiar with, which essentially was a cohort of, you know, female athletes with pre-diagnosed eating disorders. So these people had clinically diagnosed eating disorders and they noticed this, you know, increase association with osteopenia and osteoporosis, so weak bones. and a loss of a menstrual cycle, so amenorrhea. So generally you need to have lost your cycle completely for at least 6 months to sort of fit into that category. And I think, you know, when you look at that, they're all really extreme states. Like even one of those things is pretty extreme, but to need to have all three, or to need to have two out of the three, like that's still really severe. And I think that's where this model needed updating, and, you know, further research has started that process. But essentially what they've established is that the three points of that triad are not equal, but everything's stemming from the energy deficiency.
Yeah.
And far more is stemming from that. It's not just bones and sex hormones. And, you know, yeah, women lose their cycle, but I think, you know, something that I had reached out to you about, I guess, just to sort of assess your experience more as an athlete, is that I think in a way it's a blessing for females to have a menstrual cycle, because we have a monthly opportunity to sort of touch base with where we're at. Yeah. Like as soon as that goes on the blink, that's a big red flag for me. And that was when I reached out to you, because I, for the first time, I actually stumbled into, you know, essentially Reds by just increasing volume, and I didn't realize. So at the end of 2020, I had a really amazing sort of lead into the race that I couldn't do. and I, in retrospect, I wasn't eating enough, and I think I'd probably experienced a bit of appetite suppression through that phase. Like when I actually look back at what I was eating, I'm like, you know what? It wasn't enough. I know it wasn't enough. Yeah. But I think men are definitely susceptible to this, but don't get an opportunity to really monitor for that.
Because as a female, if you lose your cycle, well, okay, something's changing.
Something's up. Yeah. You, and I think we're getting a bit better, but in general, and I think where we're coming from again is historically there's been this mentality, particularly in the competitive ends of female sport, where often it's this ethos of, if you're still getting your period, you're not training hard enough.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of where we've come from. And I think there's been a lot of growth there. There's still so much work to do.
And like I'm, you know, touch wood, I haven't like had any disordered eating. Although like the more I think about it, the more I may have. I'm sure a lot of people out there can identify with the fact that you run lots. And if you run, then you start to, you know, maybe shed a couple of kilos, or you start to get a bit leaner, and then you might go, oh, this is pretty good. Mm. I might, you know, if I just don't have that, you know, extra sandwich, whatever it might be, cool, that's less calories, and then that's a bit less in, I might get a little bit more leaner, I might lose that extra kilo, and like, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And like you can, and it probably does stem from a lot of body image stuff, and I'm not immune to that. And you know, you might see yourself in the mirror, and it can go one of two ways. You might see yourself in the mirror and go, oh come on, maybe I can just eat a little bit less and just add an extra 5k onto that run, and that'll help. Or you can see yourself in the mirror and look pretty lean and go, it's pretty good. I better make sure I maintain this.
No.
So let's just not eat that extra thing.
Yeah.
And that is putting yourself into a caloric deficit, and that's when you're putting yourself in that massive risk factor for relative energy deficiency, which is what that is.
And the flow-on effects, like sure, there's bones and sex hormones, but, you know, there's impacts on your immune system, there's impacts on your cardiovascular health, there's impacts on your gut health. And honestly, like, I had so many gut issues. I've been in front of so many gastroenterologists, and as soon as I started eating, so much of that is gone. Like,
and are you keto right now, Sal?
No.
Fuck no.
And look, you know, I think there is still merit to some of that, but, and again, it comes back to how biased we are when we're reading stuff, because, you know, sure, there's some really good science on keto. And I think, you know, if you've got sort of, like Alzheimer's stuff, or if you're type 2 diabetic, or if you're morbidly obese with cardiovascular disease, that's pretty much where all this research has come from. And I'm reading that and applying it to me, who's like early 30s, slim, really active, and thinking that that's a positive outcome. And, you know, I think there are ways to do it properly, but they don't involve any form of calorie restriction. You can still eat a different way.
You shouldn't be restricting your calories like that if you're training 100 Ks a week and going to the gym and doing spin classes as well.
Absolutely not.
If I can do Pilates for fun if you have time.
But yeah, I think, you know, the people that are at risk for this generally, there are going to be sports that are more prone to it. And I think ultimately, unfortunately, running is always going to be a weight dependent sport. You
Yeah.
Generally, if you're lighter, you're probably going to move faster, and that's basic physics.
That's physics, yeah.
Yeah, and it sucks, but it's true. And so there's always that tendency that lighter is better, but there's a definite point of diminishing returns there, and that's what you don't realize you're hitting up against until you fall off that cliff.
And unfortunately for us, we see all the most successful runners are probably towing that line all the time.
But they're also doing it in a cyclic way. Like, yeah, they may be sort of manipulating things leading into a race season to be at a race weight, but that's not what they're doing in the off season, and they have an off season. Whereas, you know, I think there's so many events these days, you just, especially in Victoria, like, and I mean, it's hard now that COVID's kind of messed with everyone's plans, but you know, there are events every weekend. Mm. And so people don't necessarily realize how much they're doing. They're seeing athletes when they're at peak performance, when they're at their leanest. Mm. That's not necessarily what they look like 6 months later.
Yeah.
And you're trying to achieve that ideal constantly.
Yeah. And probably maintain it throughout the year and get FOMO when you have a race and you're not fit or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, weight dependent sports like running, road cycling, you know, rock climbing, and then aesthetic dependent sports like gymnastics or bodybuilding or dance, those things, you know, you get a much higher correlation of this with an eating disorders with those sports as well. But I think there's personality attributes and, you know, being highly driven, A-type kind of perfectionistic qualities, which I definitely fit
does
all of those.
Does that sound familiar, Sal?
I know. You know, there can be all sorts of other psychological things. And I guess that where it gets super complex is what came first, the running or the disordered eating or the eating disorder? And I think if, you know, running unfortunately can be added into the mix to fuel, it's probably a poor choice of words, but you know, to feed into disordered
feed is also a
I know, shit. but you know what I mean, it's like there can be a pre-existing issue there and they're using running to aid that, or you started loving running and, you know, I think that's more what I fall into. The motivation to keep running was the thing that kept you kind of, I guess, fueling this, and I think that's the group that a lot more recreational runners potentially fall into without realizing. And I think that's, you know, highly reversible as well.
Mm.
All of these things are reversible to a degree. I think there are some extreme cases, unfortunately, with particularly with, you know, female youth athletes where they never got their period and the sort of effects of their long-term bone health have been huge.
Massive.
But I think for, you know, the majority of people out there in the recreational sphere, anything you've potentially started heading down is definitely reversible.
And it's getting – so we know that a lot of your bone mineral density is achieved throughout your adolescent years. So it's to the point where the Australian Institute of Sport, if it identifies elite triathletes, they actually get them out of triathlon for a number of years during their adolescent period and say, go and play like netball and soccer and basketball and do all these different things.
Yeah,
because doing different sports actually builds up the density of your bones.
Yeah.
And so when they're like, you know, 18 or 19, they're like, hey, come back and do triathlon, remember this. And it's actually the best way to like build strong, healthy bones. And that's just like an actual priority for the Australian Institute of Sport right now. When they identify elite teenagers, instead of training them hard when they're 15, they don't, because that will affect their performance later. And that's a lot of that does come down to bone mineral density. And so when we're talking about red S, that's one of the things. And that's like, yeah, how do you know if you've got red S or you're at risk or whatever? Or have you had a stress fracture that you can't explain? And that's unfortunate. And for me as a physio, I've seen a number of stress fractures, and sure, it's like, yeah, maybe you ran more and you put more load into your bones and your bone couldn't tolerate it. But I think I'm at a point now, if I see any bone stress, I think, cool, yeah, you've been running more, your bone's not been able to tolerate it, like simple. But there's now that always that element of what's going on that's made your bone, you know, a little bit weaker, or what's going on, is there something else there? And so if you've had any bone stuff that just doesn't really make sense, like, man, you've got to like take a broader look at this whole picture, right? And that's especially if you've had like a second stress fracture, I mean, man, we got to investigate this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, in general, particularly for women and I think for men as well, if you're I think the other sort of difficulty is the popularity of these endurance sports is increasing. Like you don't just start running necessarily now to run your park run. People are shooting for ultra marathons from the get-go.
We're at the point where marathons aren't that impressive anymore. No. Everyone fucking does marathons. Everyone's they're not that hard. 10 years ago when I did my first marathon, most people were like, whoa, my God, you just ran a marathon. I was like, I know, it's crazy. But like that is now 100Ks.
Yeah.
The needle has shifted.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
And I think if you're taking on that sort of endeavor, it probably does pay to, one, you really do need to think about yourself as an athlete. And I think, you know, calling yourself that is important because it is what you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, essentially that's your additional job to everything else that you're doing. And it's voluntary, but you need to take responsibility for managing that. Just running isn't enough. You know, I think touching base with the GP and getting some baseline bloods is a good idea for most people that are running consistently. Because, again, like there can be other things going on that can sort of add fatigue or stress to your system. But particularly from hormonal disruption perspective, like getting a bit of a trend on what your hormones are doing over a series of tests is really helpful. I think for women, if there's any sort of disruption to your menstrual cycle, you really need to pay attention to that. Whether you want to have babies or not, I give zero fucks. It's honestly something you need to pay attention to. Yeah. And I think there's a lot more, again, a lot more sort of science and people in this space now that are doing a lot of work into how to work with your cycle. And I think, you know, training around your cycle is something that I've sort of done a lot of playing around with and reading about. And I think there's some really good resources there as well. So I think for female athletes, don't see it as a burden. It really can be a superpower. Like you can time sort of the way you're training to really optimize your adaptive responses if you understand your physiology and you're working with it instead of constantly working against it. So track your cycle. For men, and look, I guess this is, I think it's hard, you know, and you've probably experienced it as a male practitioner that, you know, asking an athlete that's walked in the door with their second stress fracture, who's female and maybe a bit slight, are you going to jump straight into, so have you had a period recently? Like it can be.
Well, I'm at the point now where I will.
Good. Like, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think it needs to, like, it just is. It's nothing to sort of be weird about, but I guess, you know, from a coaching perspective, like I will generally be having that conversation with my female athletes and, you know, I encourage them to record, you know, so I train through Training Peaks and I encourage them to document when day one of their cycle is because I may modify the way that I'm programming for them. And it's a way for us to just track, you know, if that the days between day one of your cycle is stretching out as we build, well, maybe we need to have a bit of a chat about what are you doing nutrition wise or sleep wise, like touch base in that. What's the male equivalent? Because I've got male athletes and, you know, it's like, how do I, I'm quite comfortable talking about it with women, but what's the equivalent for guys? And and that's where I guess, you know, I probably need to just suck it up and have a bit more of a chat because it seems like in terms of early signs of lowering testosterone, frequency of morning erections is some of the things that you need to be looking out for. And, you know, am I going to just say, so how many boners have you had this week? Like,
well, maybe you should.
I know, maybe I should. So boys that I train, like,
yeah,
feel free to document. but I mean, you know, listening to, I guess, some of the sort of doctors that are doing a lot of work into this space, that is kind of floated as a bit of a litmus test for, you know, if that's not happening a couple of times a week, maybe that's a bit of a trigger to, you know, have a bit of a closer look and get some bloods or, you know, have a chat to a doctor. I think, you know, when it's an unintentional energy deficit, it's a much more mechanical, mathematical kind of issue. Like if it's just ignorance or, you know, poor choices or just got lazy and didn't plan meals and just sort of forgetting to eat, or maybe they do experience some appetite suppression with high volume, recognizing all of that, getting an eating plan, just eating more calories is going to work.
And a sports, you know, sports dietitian, sports nutrition should be able to help you with that.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, as someone who has sat in front of sports doctors and a sports psychologist and three dietitians, I still was very good at using all of them to fuel my disordered thoughts and eating patterns rather than actually finding it all that helpful.
Yeah.
But the more times people asked me about it and forced me to kind of answer whether I knew I was lying or not, I think when that door gets knocked on enough times, you really do start to realize you probably have to have a look inwards.
Yeah.
So I think the more we're talking about it, the better. And I think the more connected we are. So I think it's important that if you're coaching, that you do sort of get a bit up to speed on this. And if you've got, you know, if you're seeing endurance athletes like physios, I think we need to build our network to support runners. And I think if you're in, you know, the social running community and you're noticing changes in people, like they're constantly coming up to, sort of runs even when they're injured, I think that's a big red flag.
Yeah.
You
there's
know,
probably
I think...
some exercise addiction stuff happening there. Yeah,
definitely.
Which is hard, like, again, it's hard to navigate.
Yeah, it's hard to navigate. And I think, you know, as a running community, if we recognize none of us want to be excluded for injury, well, there's other ways to be involved. Like you can volunteer, you can sort of help.
Bring an esky.
Yeah, exactly. You know, be the photographer for the day, you know, feed their social media stream. Like there's lots of us ways for us to integrate people. But I think it's important for people that are dealing with endurance athletes that you've got your referral network. So, you know, have someone that's receptive from a nutrition perspective that you can refer at-risk people onto, and a sports doctor that you know is, you know, a bit across this sort of stuff. Like, I think we need to be able to manage this in a sort of multi-practitioner way.
I've had a couple of experiences there where I've taken me all of my power and energy to get someone to see a sports doctor or a nutritionist to get, I guess, that further, like that extra opinion.
Yeah.
Like someone who will agree with me who is in a place of like power or knowledge, I suppose.
Or it's more their area of expertise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I shout out to him if he's listening, because he knows exactly who he is. But I had a patient one time who came in with some and kudos to me, fully openly, just straight up said, yeah, I've had anorexia and I just lost 16 kilos and I'm into my running.
Yeah.
And I, because of that, I got this bone stress issue and I went to a nutritionist and I've done all this sports talk. And I'm like, whoa, okay, he's done everything.
Yeah.
So there's kind of different ways to approach this, right? And for you, it took a long time, but you eventually got down to that like accepting of what's going on here.
Yeah.
But I think what this particular person did, which is really awesome, is he's got a good doctor on board, a good sports doctor on board, amazing nutritionist on board, who I just like happens to get in touch with the day before I first met this guy. And I was like, I think I know who your nutritionist is.
Yeah.
But he had all the right people on his team. And then I was kind of the final piece of his puzzle that helped manage more of the physical loading stuff.
Yeah.
And he's managed that pretty successfully.
Yeah.
And like you, Sal, you've managed that pretty successfully. And now you're at a point where I think what's really cool is you've got a very healthy relationship with food. And you're like, we did a run the other day and we just smashed a breakfast.
Hells yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, again, I think I still have work to do. And, you know, the last couple of months, again, brought that to the fore. So for me, like losing my cycle through unintentional reds brought back a whole lot of stuff, I guess, and essentially I think it's still guilt of where I've been. And so I was like, shit, I promised myself I would never do this. I would never use exercise.
So when that happens, did you run less or eat more?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, again, my body was holding up well. There was still a glimmer of hope that this race might happen for me, that maybe they'd relax restrictions. But And so for me, it was, I'm going to hold my volume the same. And if I wake up and I really don't feel like running, I'm not going to run.
Yeah.
And I intentionally was eating more for that week. But during that week, there was a lot coming up for me because I'm like, okay, well, I'm in an energy deficit. I essentially, for the last 3 years since I've sort of worked through a lot of this, I've been eating very much intuitively. Like the only things I'd been tracking really were how many calories I could consume on a long run, because for me it's about gearing my gut up for like how much can I get in.
Like,
so really it was more to my max, not my min, and making sure that I hit my protein window post big efforts, because I think as female athletes that's super important. So those were pretty much the only things I was tracking, and if in doubt, just have more carbs. But that wasn't enough. And so for me, the big next hurdle is the fact that, you know, I potentially need to navigate tracking food in some way again. And that scares the shit out of me.
So do you think that your intuitive eating is not enough eating?
I think for the volume I was trying to sustain, so, you know, getting back up to, and I don't think it even matters the number of kilometers, because I think really kilometers per week is so relative to how fast you're running, and it's more about like time and stuff. But for me, that was like the biggest month of training I've ever done. And I do think, as I sort of said before, I think there was some appetite suppression going on. Like, I was just forgetting to eat, or didn't realize I hadn't really had that much, or wasn't maybe taking that much in on longer efforts. The concept of turning food back into numbers for me scares the shit out of me. And I actually have an appointment with the dietitian tomorrow. It's taking a little while to get in, but I guess I've recognized that that's my next hurdle, is that I don't want to shy away from big volume weeks because my body is ready for it. Like, there were no niggles. I was doing well. You know, I'm a resilient enough person that I should be able to manage my nutrition through that. And if that means working through some more stuff, great. Like, I'm ready. Let's do it. But yeah, this sort of thought of, well, what does that actually look like? Shit, I just can't get my head around tracking anything, or, as I said, turning food back into numbers for me is really confronting. So, you know, I've learned on my network, I guess, and that's where I think the more we talk about it, the more you realize how common it is. Like, pretty much any woman I have gone on a long run with has experienced this to some level. Like, it's everywhere. And I think, you know, talking to people like, who have you found helpful, you know, who worked for you, like, you build your network a little bit through that. So, you know, I found, I've got a short list of dietitians that, you know, seem to be doing a lot of work in the red space and working with female athletes. So I'm excited to have a chat to someone and see if we can sort of come up with a way that will help me put a plan in place, so the next time I'm peaking for a race, I'm not shying away from
those bigger days,
from the bigger days, because I don't want to, you know, deal with food. And so I think the other important thing, and again, why I kind of reached out to you, Patty, when I was initially sort of putting some feelers out, was, you know, during that same period, I've posted intermittently on social media about my kind of journey and my struggles, and I don't ever do it. I guess really the only way, or the only time I'm motivated to talk about it, is because I think talking about it helps people look inwards sometimes. Like, if there's one person listening to this podcast that goes, you know what, there's a few traits there that are ringing a bell, and maybe I am, you know, potentially not making choices that are congruous with my long-term goals, then great. But the people, every time I sort of post, there's so many people that reach back that are either at the beginning of that recovery journey, or they've been there before, or they're worried they know someone that's there. Like, it's overwhelming. And spontaneously, sort of through that kind of end of December, early January period, six different people, completely unrelated people, had reached back out saying, I'm having trouble at the moment. Like, and so was I. And so I think, you know, it's not a linear journey to recovery. And just because I've been eating really well and training fine for 3 years doesn't mean that there's not still work to do sometimes. Yeah. And that doesn't mean that I'm weak, or that, you know, I've regressed or anything. It's just, it's not a linear journey. It's like training. Like, you sort of have an up, and then you got to go down for a little bit, then you go up, and then you got to go down for a bit.
And every time it happens, you learn something different.
You learn something.
And then you pick that up and implement. And
exactly.
And I think being pretty open-minded about willing to learn and willing to improve and like, but seek help where you feel like
where you need it,
which is like you going to that dietitian tomorrow.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, as lucky as we are in Australia, you know, I think a lot of people were probably hitting some issues coming up to New Year's, where it became evident with the, you know, cluster in Sydney and the fact that borders snapshot that, you know, this shit show of 2020 was definitely rolling on through into the new year. Yeah. And I think it's when we're under stress and although we're super lucky in Australia and thank God, you know, we don't have thousands of people dying of COVID, it's still dramatically impacting our life and our choices and our freedom mm-hmm. and our ability to do the things that we love. And for me, you know, getting back to Victorian High Country is something I've been itching to do yeah. and it looks like that's not happening again. Like, there's been so many disappointments that it's very easy when freedom's taken away for us that we revert to old behavior patterns because they feel like an old friend. And I think a lot of eating disorders and disordered eating stems from it's a coping mechanism for something.
Yeah.
It's serving a purpose at the time. And there are times where, you know, those thoughts may slip back in again. And for me, I was experiencing, there was one long run at the end of December where I'm like, I just need to finish this block and I don't care if I don't have my period and this race isn't happening and it's all turning to shit and I just want to prove to myself that I can do it. I didn't eat before I went out. It was a 2-hour big session. I took one gel and I was at the second end of a 20-minute rep and the thought of, well, you haven't really earned this yet because you didn't quite hit your target entered my mind and I stopped running and I walked home. And I'm like, I will never run to justify eating or yeah. to earn food. And that was the first time I'd had a thought like that for years. And I'm like, this is fucked. Like, how am I back here again? Yeah. This is bullshit. Like, I'm better than this. But I think it's just a journey and you've just got to recognize it. And so, again, if there are people listening to this that have been impacted in a greater sense by COVID and are having trouble with, you know, old coping mechanisms to seek help because it's just part of the process and it's just how we learn and get stronger.
Yeah, and the fact that you were where you were several years ago going through this whole process and in front of sports doctors, sports psychologists and probably with a strong element of like, what do you guys know about me? Maybe a bit of denial or whatever. But now for you to then a couple of years down the track, be at the end of this block, long training run, halfway through, be like, fuck, here we are again. But you were able to pick up on that pretty much straight away and you just recognized it and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, cool, I know what I kind of need to do now.
Yeah.
Go and, home, you know, and have a big burger. And
exactly. Yeah. Well, I had a big protein shake and then, yeah. But I'll eat burgers. Like, yeah, again, it's one of those things I think, you know, I'm a lot more vigilant for it. I can hear when it's there, which is such a massive step forward. Mm. And you just have to keep seeing the bigger picture that in general it's forward progress and it's not always linear, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Progress in terms of like your growth as an athlete, but you're just your knowledge and understanding of like the human body and how you should feel it and how you should treat it. And if you're trying to train like an elite athlete, maybe you should try and eat like an elite athlete.
Exactly.
But if you're just trying to do a bit of running, maybe you should eat for the fact that you're doing a bit of running.
Yeah.
And this is where like, and this is what popped into my mind when earlier on you were saying that we're recreational athletes is most people don't have coaches or we might be part of a club, but there's 100 runners in the club. We're not very closely monitored, but having someone on your team who will be able to monitor that sort of stuff. And if there's any doubt or if you need any help, like get a coach, go to your doctor, get your baseline bloods tested, ask to speak to a sports doctor who's interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think having a coach and someone to have that discussion with, but also for someone to monitor your load, and I think that's super valuable for anyone.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, like lean on your network too. Like you probably know a lot of runners. Just start reaching out. Like, you know, have you got a doctor? Like, have you ever needed to see a sports doctor? Do you know anyone that's good? Do you know anyone that's used one? Like, just start talking and you'll be amazed at how many people have probably been. I guess the one thing that I'm repeatedly reminded of is that as much as I think we're all unique little snowflakes, generally, if I'm having an issue with something, plenty of other people are having the same problem.
You're not that special.
I'm really not that special. I think, you know, if you're in a community of somewhat like-minded people, then when you're having trouble, plenty of them have probably had the same trouble. Yeah. So, you know, network and talk.
And don't necessarily take their advice word for word, but just knowing that there are other people out there.
There's a lot of cowboys out there. And I think, again, that's where potentially getting a coach is a good way to go, especially, you know, with ultra marathons and things. I think some of the training that happens for those is probably lending itself to injury and all sorts of sort of things. But
yeah,
and I think, you know, it's really, really helped me grow as an athlete and helped me, you know, moving into the coaching sphere as well. Like, it's given me a lot more knowledge and insight and tools, I guess, to be able to use to support athletes if I think that there are some issues there. And I guess how I structure things, which, you know, comes back to maybe the next podcast we do, which is so I train with power. And, you know, the power meter for me, essentially what really keeps bringing me back to power is that it's the ultimate way for me to quantify stress in my athletes. So what I'm prescribing and what they're doing. And I think that's really important to me, given I coach mainly online or, you know, from afar. It's important to have ways for us to be monitoring what's actually going on and I guess cues and where we maybe sort of initiate some conversations along the way.
That's a big discussion.
Big discussion.
Which I want to have with you.
Yeah.
Which we'll,
I think there's plenty to chat about.
we'll park it and we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But Sally's in the process of trying to get me to use the power meter so she can just look at how fucked up I am.
I'm not fucked up at all.
Yeah, fucked up.
I just want to see what you do.
I just
want to be a fly on the wall with a hell of a lot more insight.
Fly on every wall. Well, Sally, thank you. Firstly, like, thank you so much for sharing that. That's like, that takes a bit of guts to actually like put that out there. But I know that you're doing it to help one other person and then hopefully help more than one other person. But
yeah,
I'm sure that, like, we know there are a lot of people listening to this, and I have no doubt in my mind there are a bunch of people who've been in your shoes or are currently there now. And please, like, reach out to us, like me, reach out to Sal. We'll put Sal's Insta attached to this. So we're here. I mean, we can point you in the direction of a doctor, a nutritionist, people to help. But it's something that I think we need to talk about and discuss and then be able to know where to get help.
Yeah.
I suppose.
But yeah, I think the first step is just reaching out and, you know, again, if you're not in that sort of intentional state, just educating yourself a little bit more too. So reading up a bit more about things as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, just reach out. I'm always happy for someone to slide into my DMs about this sort of stuff.
Just for that reason, though.
Yes.
Sal's actually married, so stop thinking that way. Okay, well, thanks, Sal. None of this is really new to me, but I also learned something. So, like, that's really cool. I look forward to our next few months of UTA training together because we're going to run 100Ks in the bush.
Hells yeah.
And we're going to talk about power stuff. I'm going to start using it.
Yes. Sounds fun. Thanks,
man. I finished my beer, like, 35 minutes ago, and Sally still hasn't finished hers, so I'm a bit disappointed. Anyway.
Been talking too much.
You've been talking to her. I haven't been talking in at all. This has been the easiest podcast I've ever done. All right. Thank you, Sal. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And learn more about Reddit.
Later.
Bye.